Today's episode with my friend Andrew Gurevich is the last live recording that I was able to do when I was recently in the States. I was over there for about 6 weeks, September and October of this year, and I was able to travel down and stay with Andrew and his wife Celeste one of the weekends I was there. And it was really cool because I hadn't been in Portland for, well, I thought it was about 10 years, but it turns out it was at least 8 years since I've been there. But I actually used to live in Portland. We lived there for about 13 years. I was a Bible college student, a seminary student, and then I became an elder and a pastor at a local church just south of Portland, and I was there for about 12 years at this church. And Andrew and I went to Bible college, we went to seminary together, we even went to the same church together for a while, we played on the same worship team, I was the drummer, he was one of the guitar players. So we go way, way back. And in fact, Andrew and I did a couple of podcast episodes earlier this year. If you want to go back and listen to those, it'll kind of give you a bit of Andrew's backstory, which, by the way, let me tell you, that is a fascinating story. You almost can't make it up as he talks about growing up with a father who was in the mafia, going into evangelicalism and getting out of it. And now he's a teacher in the Portland area. He is becoming an expert on mythology. He's written articles on Paleolithic cave art, and he's really intensely interested in exploring world religions and spirituality in terms of human history going back tens of thousands of years. I thoroughly enjoyed that chat. I learned a lot, actually. It was a wide-ranging, absolutely fascinating conversation, so I really encourage you to go back and listen to those two episodes. Now, in this episode today, we're not going to be talking about Andrew's backstory so much. We want to talk about this idea that I've been really focusing on, something that I'm really passionate about, something that's really changed my focus, really ever since Stacey Ray and I did our live podcast in Seattle in September, focusing on reconstruction after deconstruction. A lot of people, I think, that come out of evangelicalism or just religion in general, they are focused so much on the deconstruction piece, and it is hugely important. Absolutely it is. In fact, this is something that I talked about with the guys from the Pilgrims and Prodigals podcast just a few weeks ago. You can catch those episodes as well. We talk about the importance, yes, of the deconstruction piece, and obviously that's a huge part of going through this process, leaving your religion behind, questioning the things you were taught, questioning what you believed. But what happens then? Because a lot of us, I think, we can get stuck in a rut. We can get stuck in a groove. This is something that Janice Selby and I talked about a few weeks ago. She calls it perseveration, and it's a kind of a clinical term. It's this idea of someone seeking closure, but you're stuck. It's like an old vinyl record getting stuck in a groove and going around and around and getting stuck in this cycle, and you can't seem to get out of it, kind of a rigid thinking. And what Janice mentioned is that we tend to do that. We're getting so stuck maybe in the anger cycle that we can't seem to move past that. There's the bitterness, there's the grief, there's the loss, there's even the rage at how we were mistreated, how we were misled, maybe lied to. We feel like someone who's come out of a cult in some ways. And so she said, you got to somehow work through that process and then get out of that rut, get out of that perseveration. And in order to do that, you might even need to go seek therapy or counseling. Some people have found a lot of benefits from doing so. And this is why I'm really glad to be bringing you this conversation with Andrew Gurevich today, because we go beyond just talking about how we were mistreated within the evangelical system. And absolutely we were. And I think that's an important piece to acknowledge, that you can't just say, well, I'm angry, I'm bitter, I was hurt, I was misled, mistreated, lied to, whatever. That all may be true in so many cases, but you've got to somehow work through that, acknowledge it, but find a way to move past it. And you've got to ask yourself, is this something that I can sustain? Can I sustain the anger, the bitterness, and live that way? And I've come to see now that you really can't. Well, actually you can, but it's so, so unhealthy to stay in the anger and the bitterness of the past. So we've got to find ways to acknowledge that and move on. And so that's what I want to do in this chat with Andrew Gurevich today as we talk about a lot of things that come out of evangelicalism, but looking at spirituality, looking at other paths to move forward and to find a way to get past that, get out of that groove, get out of the rut of the anger and the bitterness. And that's something that I've really been focusing on, as I say, in the last 5-6 months, this idea of reconstructing your identity post-deconstruction and post-religion. So that's what I want to do moving forward and into the new year as well. Now, before I bring you the chat with Andrew, I want to mention really quickly that if you want to be a supporter of Mindshift Podcast on Patreon, that is hugely helpful. Basically, this is the way I'm looking to make my living now. Now that I don't have a job anymore, no one's going to hire me to be a Bible college teacher anymore, I'm pretty sure. So I'm writing, I'm doing the podcast. That is the way that I see my future going forward, doing this full time, which is something I'm really passionate about, something that I love to help other people. You can support what I'm doing on Patreon, and the links to that are in the show notes. You get early access to every show on Wednesday, and also I put up a video now. I'm working on a series. Once a month, I'll put up another video. They're about 15 to 20 minutes long on this process of reconstruction after deconstruction. I've done 2 already. One's kind of an introduction, an overview to the whole course. I did one last month where I talk about deconstructing biblical inerrancy, and I'm going to be doing one in the month of December called Deconstructing God. And I'm going to show you how the connection between biblical inerrancy goes on into evangelical views of God and biblical views of God, really, if you really break it down and look at it that way. So we're going to take a look at that next month in the month of December. So that's a great reward for being a supporter of Mindshift Podcast on Patreon. All right, so let's go on into it. Here then is my conversation with Andrew Gurevich, recorded live in September down in Portland, Oregon. I invite you to come along with us on this journey as we talk about reconstruction, the total reorientation of your former worldview. I'm sitting here with Andrew Gurevich, the aging prophet.
Aging still.
We're not getting any younger, man. I tell you, man.
I use that early on and when the internet first started, and I was really scared that I was going to get on some list. Because the word prophet was in my email thing. And when I still give it out at like banks and stuff, people give me this weird look and I have to explain, you know, lowercase p, it's actually a biblical term. The aging prophet, right?
The aging prophet.
It's a biblical term.
It's a biblical term. We've since deconstructed a lot. This is a weird kind of thing because we're sitting down here in Portland right now in Andrew's house. Thank you for putting me up too, by the way.
Awesome,
that
man.
Was cool. We had a great time last night. In fact, we met some friends of yours and your wife's that we're going to talk about her story a little bit too, I think.
Absolutely.
But she's a struggling ex-evangelical, perhaps, as well.
Ex-evangelical.
So,
I love this phrase.
Ex-evangelical. So this has been a strange trip. I haven't been in Portland for 10 years.
Wow.
So it's a surreal thing because last night I went out to dinner with a friend of mine, Mike, who was our worship/associate pastor when I was a pastor of a church in Portland. And then just now I've gotten back from having breakfast with Marvin, who's another friend who went through all the stuff with the church closing down and all the nightmarish scenario that went down. So it's a surreal thing navigating Portland again, because I used to live here.
Yeah.
And it reminded me last night when I was coming home from having dinner with Mike that it's sort of like the old grooves of evangelicalism. I remember how to get places in Portland because I used to live here. But yet I'm still wondering, am I getting lost? And I go, okay, I made the right turn. Yeah, I remember this.
Why does it not feel right? Yeah,
it's still, and it reminds me of, you know, the whole thing about evangelicalism that we both came out of it.
Yeah.
We went to Bible college together. We went to seminary together. We both since walked away from the church.
Yeah.
And I would say Christianity as well.
Yeah.
So, but we don't want to just, I guess, talk about all the bullshit that went on in the past. We've been doing a lot of that.
Yeah.
And you were on the podcast, what was it, about 8 months ago?
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
And that was really cool.
That was awesome.
We talked about all kinds of stuff, your backstory. If people want to listen to that episode or those 2 episodes,
yeah,
Those were really good. We got into Paleolithic cave art and all this other stuff.
Yeah, that's my groove, man. Yeah, I love that stuff. That was fun talking about. You know, and not we talked about it then, but like the reason that stuff appealed to me was that, you know, we were talking last night about like our time in Bible college and seminary.
Oh,
and
yeah.
We tend to start growing towards the things that pissed us off. What was this guy talking about? What the hell happened here? What was this guy saying in this class? How come this person treated me this way? And one of the things I was saying was, gosh, that's absolutely true. All of that happened.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I remember all of that trauma and we carry it. And it's a huge reason why I walked away from the faith. And like we talked about, those kind of individual traumas opened up. It wasn't like a person pissed me off in the church and then I was like, screw Christianity because Steve over here and I had an argument, right? It opened up the space for me to start questioning the entire structure. But then we were like, why do we keep coming back, man? Why did we spend all this money? Why were we here?
And we invested so much.
There was something that kept pulling. There was there was something instinctual in us that was reaching for something that we were at least partially getting, or else we wouldn't have kept subjecting ourselves and our families to
something that. Something was compelling.
Yeah. And so the reason I went back to the Paleolithic is I was like, our people, since we've been a species, since we've really been creating culture, we've been creating artifacts that have been trying to bridge this gap between the seen and the unseen world and trying to somehow navigate that space and find our place in it. And like I said in the other podcast, the Paleolithic is interesting to me because this is a time period before we're French or German or Spanish, before we're Catholic or Muslim, and none of that applies. And we get this kind of undifferentiated human culture that can stand sort of directly in the presence of transcendence. And it's very mysterious to work with, but it's also like you strip away all these levels of orthodoxy and of combative interpretations and the diminishing returns that comes from hiding in an orthodoxy. So it's cool to do that work.
Yeah. And of course, as we talked about in the other podcast, Christians, and I would say probably more than Christians too, they're freaked out because you're describing stuff that's 25 to 40,000 years old.
Yeah.
And that predates the biblical records and all the rest of it. So they're very threatened, I think, by that. This is something we talked about last night with my friend, and his wife was she's still really much in the evangelical mold. She was kind of like, whoa, well, wait a minute.
Yeah.
40,000 years old. That's against the Bible. That, you know, the earth is 6 to 10,000 years old, Andy. I mean, yeah, you know, you could see the cognitive dissonance. So, you know, we had an interesting conversation around that piece.
We're both theology students, and you know, we have some background with the original languages. And are you aware of a place in the Bible where it tells us the Earth is 6 to 10,000 years old? Like I understand where this was calculated.
Yep.
It was that medieval monk that added up all of the begats and numbers
all
and
the tried genealogies
to,
and
yeah, and then from that point tried to sort of guesstimate the age of the Earth. And we still use it when we talk about it's the year 2018 and stuff. We still play with that Gregorian nonsense because
that's
it's not 2018 at all. It's utterly meaningless.
It's an arbitrary number that they just arrived at. She just thought that's what the Bible teaches.
Yeah.
And I explained to her exactly what you just said. Somebody added up the genealogies in Genesis and a couple other things and arrived at this 6 to 10,000 year date. And she was like, but what? You know, and it was kind of rocking her world a little bit.
Man.
And then you go 40,000 years old and you find ancient civilizations that predated the flood narrative.
Yeah.
If it is indeed a global flood, and that's a problem because that shouldn't be.
Right.
It shouldn't. The whole earth should have been wiped out.
It's probably more of a regional flood.
You know, if anything, it was a regional flood and all that. So, yeah, there's a lot of issues and problems. But one of the things we talked about covering was this issue of reconstruction after deconstruction.
Yeah.
Because we've both gone down the deconstruction route. As you say, we've gone the angry atheist, the angry theist thing.
Yeah.
But how do you get beyond that? Because as I've discovered, you can't – well, you can live there.
Yeah.
But it's so unhealthy.
It is, man.
It really is. It's, and this is something my friend and I were talking about this morning is living angry. You can't stay angry. I mean, a lot of people do, but it's so unhealthy and it's so damaging to us and the people around us to be just pissed off all the time.
Yeah.
So how do you get past that? How have you gotten past that? Because we were both screwed over in many ways.
Yeah, it was brutal.
The church and Bible college and seminary. We could tell story after story after story. We kind of did last night.
Yeah, yeah. I'll tell you, you know, it's a great question. And the things that evangelicals, just back on the other point with the age of the earth, the things that evangelicals have been told they have to believe. The extra biblical structures that they've been told they have to accept without question in order for their life to make sense.
Well, and to for even their faith, be a Christian.
To even be a Christian.
In some cases, if you don't believe this, yeah. you're not even a Christian, or you might doubt it.
It's quite devastating. Things that don't, like inerrancy, inspiration, age of the earth.
It's all this big ball of wax.
Biblical literalism, which you've done a lot of shows on, and like, what does it mean to read the Bible literally? Like, one reads a piece of poetry different than one would read an epistle, different than one would read a travelogue or exactly. a narrative. But even saying that freaks many evangelicals out. But, you know, tying your faith to the age of the earth, I used to say the only event in the Bible that's described that you have to believe actually occurred in order to have faith is the resurrection. But now I believe you don't even have to literally believe in that, right? Like that the metaphorical implications of the resurrection do not start with Christianity. They only actually make sense within covenantal Judaism to begin right? In terms of this blood sacrifice for atonement. All of that is woven into a very specific contract with a very specific people in a very specific time period. But when you want to, as Christians want to, open this notion of sacrifice for atonement up, And regeneration and transformation, this doesn't start with Jesus. This is Horus. This is every ancient deity.
You can find it in other religions. Egyptology and Assyrian religions.
And when we go back to the Paleolithic, we find the same thing. People finding these concepts in the natural world of regeneration and transformation and encountering the spirit through that and how the community is built on that notion of shared sacrifice. To and receiving from this great other, mysterious other that is the source of all forms. Whatever. And so this is a great concept. And I believe Christians can believe that even without belief. I know many people of faith that are quote unquote liberal Christians that, you know, that don't even believe in the literal resurrection, but take spiritual truth from it. But to your other question about what next, you're right, man. This is what I've been spending the past couple of years working on, because what I noticed is, you know, I came out of the church and like you, I was angry and I was pissed off. You guys lied to me, man. I spent all this time, you know, and they're brutal to us, right? You know, they're really, I mean, when you would ask these questions, it was like the mob, you know, people would be really cruel. And so I had a lot of resentment and I stayed in that place. I think we talked about it on the other show. I had anger at God, even though I didn't believe in God. So I was shaking my fist at the empty sky, I called it. And you gotta, I think, you know, in healing and treatment models, like if you've come out of an abusive relationship of some kind, there is a space for that anger. Like I think ahead of it and be like, oh, well, forgive and forget and move on. You have to acknowledge the hurt and the wrong and the things that the ruptures that occurred and the total reorientation of your worldview, like the shaking that causes and the anger and the insecurity and the fear and the resentment. I think you have to experience that and be honest with yourself about that, or else you're going to bury it down and it's going to come out in different ways.
It will
come
out somehow in very unhealthy ways.
But
very damaging ways. So that's not a good option, to bury it, suppress it, deny it. You got to go through that stage.
You go through it, but then you do get to a point where you're like, can I sustain this? Like, am I just going to live the rest of my life? And you're like, fuck you, evangelicals. You know what I mean? It becomes you know, throwing eggs at churches when I go by or something. You know what I mean? There becomes a need comes up for something else. And the thing I've been thinking about lately, we talked about this the other day, is I've been using the nutrition analogy. I'll share this quickly with your audience. And it's, you know, the idea that if McDonald's and Burger King had been completely in charge of explaining to you how to feed the body, right, for 2,000 years, right? And then all of a sudden you wake up sick and malnourished and overweight, and then you're like, this is bullshit, man. Like, these guys lied to me, right?
With their
clown, they're freaking, you know, all of it's a bunch of nonsense, right? And so this is the position many of us are in when we walk away from the church, right? And so then we have a couple of choices. The first choice is, since I was lied to by these mega organizations that have claimed to be the arbiters of nutrition, there's no such thing as good nutrition now, because these people lied to me, right? And that's silly. You were lied to by people who claimed an authority that they didn't have, actually, and then used it to push a particular agenda, namely their product, into you. But the body, throughout human history, for at least the past, I want to freak your friend out, but at least the past 1.5 million years.
Wait a minute. The human, is only 6,000 years old.
Yeah, right? So the human body is basically, I mean, as we've grown, we've needed a variance in caloric intake, but basically, there's a series of things the human body needs to nourish itself, right? And there's various kinds of digestible proteins, fiber, water, phytonutrients from plants, right? So there's a hand, there's five or six things the body needs to nourish itself. And this is just true chemically. Yeah, this is just true. Yeah, from our biology. Now, when you go through human history, people, depending on when they live, where they live, how they live, they find different ways of doing this. This is culture, right? So regionally, it depends on what can grow there, what technologies they have and have developed, if agriculture's there, if they eat animals or not. But within that variation, you have people nourishing the body the same way with proteins, vegetables, just water, fiber. Yeah, the same four or five things. There was a German anthropologist named Adolf Bastian, and he's really influential in Joseph Campbell's work, who's really important to me in the work that I do. And he talked about in myth, there was these elementary and folk ideas. And the elementary ideas are when you study all the mythic traditions of the world, you find these commonalities in them. They all sort of have these same basic structures about building self, building community through service of other. Right. So the golden rule and these kinds of things. Yeah. You sort of find them repeating in Confucius and in Hinduism and in biblical Christianity. You find the same six or eight elements repeating themselves elementally. Right. But then they're wrapped in these different cultural clothes like Confucius or Moses or whatever.
They would be.
So it's the same thing as cuisine. You have these six or eight elements that apparently the soul or the human consciousness or the spiritual animal, whatever you want to call it, that it needs to nourish itself. These are the elemental ideas, but in different cultures, it expresses itself differently, just like with the food thing, right? So where I've been going lately is this notion of, I think the human as a spiritual animal craves and desires this ability to, gather around narratives that explain some component of who we are and why we're here. Like we're meaning making creatures. Questions. Yeah. These cosmological questions of how are we to relate to one another and where do we come from? Where do we go?
Where do we go when we die?
Yeah. And there are various ways of answering this. And to answer it too definitively, it would be like saying, now that we know McDonald's isn't the truth, you have to be on the paleo diet or you have to be a vegetarian or you have to, you know what I mean? That's like saying extreme. You have to be a Christian, or you have to be a Buddhist, or you have to be
a vegetarian. You have to choose one.
Yeah. And
the others are wrong.
Different things work for different people. So in this reconstruction period, right, when we've broken apart all of the misinformation we've been given from, the churches, from the various ways of reading the text, the biblical text, how can we start to reconstruct a notion of what is the human animal? In the film Cave of Forgotten Dreams, one of the scholars talks about us being homo spiritus or homo empathicus, that we're not the knowing creature. Homo sapiens is a bad name for us. We don't actually know or understand much about the universe, but we have this desire to. And so returning to that, I think, is a good starting point. Right. And then starting to survey the landscape of where we're at. Again, I'm not some kind of Joseph Campbell maniac. I got plenty of problems with that guy, too. But one of the things he said that I'm interested in is he was like, any concept, any mythological concept that you're embracing has to embrace the science of the day as much as it can. And so your cosmological understanding has to jive with the best understanding of that time that science can provide. Right. And so you and I started talking a little bit about quantum physics and cause I see, there's a long answer. So I'm going to shut up. Right. But I see I'll stop here in a second. Right. I see two things like going backwards. Right. So this is why I'm interested in the Paleolithic, because I think we can find these foundational elements we can find in early human culture, the first attempts at providing these avenues to these encounters with non-local consciousness.
Yeah,
right?
They're trying to get there.
Yeah. And so going back to the very beginning of how that all started in our species, I think can give some interesting clues for where it started to go wrong, where it started to become concretized, where orthodoxy starts to take over.
Human nature though, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But, systematize, concretize.
Yeah.
Start providing structures and strictures around these things, and then we've got it figured out.
Yeah.
And then it becomes institutionalized.
Right.
And there you go.
Absolutely. And I think I'm no expert in quantum physics either. I've been reading about it for a while, and there's a great book out now by a guy named Paul Levy called The Quantum Revelation that is, is one of the best things I've read on it to date. The problem with quantum physics is that you, to really understand it, you need to be a physicist and understand all the math, right? And
there's
I don't.
Not many of those around.
Yeah, and so I've tried to read a couple of the technical stuff, and it's way over my head, right? And then there's folks who try to take what the discoveries happening in quantum physics and then explain it to idiots like me.
To the layperson.
But the problem with many of these books is that they become very new agey, right? Because some of the things that the physicists are actually discovering in the laboratory about the nature of material reality, they can sound a little new agey, right? And so what the problem is there are authors, popular authors, that are grabbing these things and explaining them in ways that really appeal to like hippies and folks that go to Burning Man and Esalen and that whole scene. And so they're grabbing onto this, hey, quantum, man, it's all consciousness. And
the way forward.
Yeah, and it's just another rebranding of kind of you know, so when the New Age movement started in the United States, it was just kind of an Americanized Hinduism.
Yeah, we just took Eastern concepts and made them American. And well, the Beatles did it.
Man. Yeah, exactly. And so this quantum thing is a little, when you go start digging into it, unfortunately what you run into is a lot of this kind of, it's all energy, man. You know, you run into this kind of gobbledygook.
Science, in a sense.
Yeah, right. From lay people, you know, trying to explain it to other lay people.
Dumbing it down. But in the process, something's gotten fundamentally changed.
Yeah,
what this guy's talking about.
Well,
he has
to
be a mathematician.
Yeah,
what the hell he's talking about?
I started hanging with a couple of these guys because I would go to these consciousness conferences, and some of these folks, a guy named Manos Kafatos, what tradition is he teaching? A guy named Gurcharan Khalsa, who's also a physicist. Is he a Sikh? He's going to kill me if I get this wrong. But there's a lot of folks that work at like Chapman University and these other places that are doing like research, objective research.
Yeah. Research.
Scientific, like repeatable, objectified, like
they're
testable.
Not sitting around meditating.
Like results. Yeah. Like real research. And what the quantum revelation has been finding is two things, and I'll try to break them down to the best as quickly as I can, the best I can understand it. And one is this notion of quantum connectivity or entanglement, right?
Everything's somehow connected.
Yeah, the notion is that, and they've been able to demonstrate this, that once two particles have been in contact with one another, they will forever influence each other's activity. So if you have a photon and then another photon and they've ever touched or been in the same vicinity, and then even if they fly apart and go a million miles away, and even if it's a million years later, no such thing, of course, right?
Because the Earth's only
6,000 years. Yeah. But with this particle moves in a certain way, the one over here will move in a certain way, even if they're a million miles apart and it's 1,000 years later, right? That if they've ever been in contact, they will forever influence each other's behavior. Well, according to any cosmology I've ever heard, the Big Bang says that all matter was in contact, right? Because it was all in this infinitesimally small, you know, infinitely dense ball. But creation stories says that God creates ex nihilo out of his own mind. And so even there, right? Like even in the biblical account, everything was once together inside the mind of the creator, right? Either way, it manifests connected to itself, right? Intimately. And this is mathematically proven now. The second thing that quantum folks have figured out, and quantum science is the most sophisticated measuring tool science has ever come up with in terms of like devices to measure physical reality. This is the most precise ever developed. And the other thing they've discovered, and this is where all the problem comes in, is consciousness has made its way into the laboratory. What the math is showing them is not that consciousness is something that developed in the human animal after a certain level of Darwinian evolution. Like, so we've been talking about what to replace it with, right?
Exactly.
And, you know, our misplaced biblicism that we came out of. And the problem is the Darwinian model basically says this: your life is an accident, right? Like you're, a bunch of chemicals randomly, assembled in the universe, smashed into each other, cooled off enough to create these little fish that crawled out of the water. And now, you know, a billion years later, here you are. But your life is meaningless and it's an accident and it exists between two infinite poles of blackness.
And when you die, that's just the end of it.
Right. And we tell this to people, right? And we go, you know, no, you're not, it's not heaven and hell and Peter at the pearly gates and the Ten Commandments. You know, what your life actually is utterly meaningless chemicals smashing into each other in a constant state of decay. And then we release people into the world and wonder why they're depressed and alcoholics and have like anxiety. You know what I mean? Because you've literally just said, no, your life means nothing.
It's a nihilistic worldview at the end of the day. If you take it to its logical conclusion, it is meaningless.
And we've talked to evangelicals who are like freak out when you try to talk to them. I have many friends who are atheists and they freak out when I start talking about the universe having inherent meaning.
Right.
They're like, don't you fucking tell me, man. It's meaningless. It's pointless. My life means nothing. They cling to that as much as folks that I know cling to a young earth. Don't you tell me
my life means nothing.
Yeah, yeah. My life means nothing, you son of a bitch.
I'm damn proud of it.
Yeah, I dare you, right?
I am meaningless.
And they'll cling to that, man. I know a lot of folks that are desperately clinging to that.
They're just as fundamentalist then.
Yeah.
In their orthodoxy, as it were. Mm-hmm. You can be just as fundamentalist to be as extreme liberal or conservative or atheist.
Atheist, yeah.
Yeah, fundamentalist, but not confined to Christianity or Islam or some other religion, is it?
Right. So the father of quantum physics, this guy Max Planck, and it's funny when you bring him up, people go look up his Wikipedia page and they find out he was a believer.
Ooh.
And so they get all mad at this. They go, oh, well, you can't believe him because he was Christian, so all the stuff he said was tainted, right? But he's like the stuff that you don't just have to take his word for it. He was
a brilliant
He started the math, but it's been retested since a bunch
it's
of
been
times,
proven
right?
His theories worked.
And towards the end of his life, they asked him what he learned from doing this work. And he said, I've learned that consciousness is fundamental to matter, not the other way around. That at the base of the universe, and the math shows this. Consciousness is actually fundamental, that the material world arises out of consciousness, not the other way around. Now, that doesn't make sense. That sounds like intelligent design.
Yeah.
Right? So Christians are always like, yeah, you know, cool. But like we talked about.
It's all true.
Yeah, it's all true, man. Guy lived in the belly of a great fish. But like we talked about, it affirms the unitary nature of consciousness and that it permeates the entire universe. But it is nothing like biblical Christianity or Yahwism or something like that. It doesn't look anything like this guy that sits on a throne and dispatches, angelic beings to worry about if you're jerking off or not. I mean, there's nothing like this, right? It's an entirely different notion. But in terms of where to start, at least where I'm starting, is I'm looking at this data and I'm looking at this information and what it seems, you know, when I go to the biblical text and it says things like God is love. Without turning that again into some kind of mamby-pamby thing, like, what does that mean? Like, when we look at love from a physical or from a physicist standpoint, love is really defined as the entangled attraction of two entities to one another in some kind of chemical bond for one another. And when you love something, your desire is for wellness, compassion, life-affirming. Choices
for
that thing. Yeah.
Person or thing. Yeah.
And so I've been looking at, and so what I do is I take that modern understanding of that these folks are handing us, saying this is what the universe is, right? And it's infused with consciousness and interconnected. There's not a conscious being that sits outside of it creating and it is consciousness itself. You know, when Yahweh speaks and he says, I am that I am. I am not a being. I am being itself. I am existence. I'm not a being, I am being, right, itself. So the verb, right, like it's I'm the process of being, right, of transforming elements in the universe into other things. And so then I take that understanding and start combing back through the wisdom traditions. And really, I mean, like Jefferson and folks did, had been picking and choosing the things that still apply. So much of the biblical material is just tied to a different culture and a different time and just doesn't apply to us anymore. And to try to shoehorn it in to a modern way of living is just idiotic.
That's
it's a waste of time. Yeah. And you have to live with such cognitive dissonance.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And as we talked about last night, this is the problem of the biblical literalist viewpoint, isn't it? The inerrancy, the inspiration, infallibility. You're forced to try and somehow read it literally.
Yeah.
So these old laws and the old, and the thing is, no, this is not a new concept. We know, like, for example, the reformers.
Yeah.
They struggled with it. They were going, what do we do with the law of the Old Testament? You know, they break it down into civil law, you know, ceremonial law, moral law. We're not bound by the civil, we're not bound by the ceremonial, but we're still bound by the moral law, the principles that, you know, and all that, and they struggled with it 500-600 years ago. So this is not a new problem. It paints yourself into a corner in a sense when you go down that line, if you're going to do the literalist reading of the Bible, you have to account for all of it and also defend the God of the Old Testament and on and on and on. So yeah, that's a real issue for biblical literalism. And we were both there, I think, at one point or another.
Absolutely. Trying to defend those same things, man. I can remember
having this conversation.
Same arguments with
people. I wrote papers on theodicy and defending God and genocide in the Old Testament, horrible laws. And, well, it was a different context, a different culture, a different blah, 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 blah. But God still commanded those laws. In the text, the straight reading of it says, God commanded these horrible things.
Yeah.
So what do we do with that God? You know, so that's a whole other issue, isn't it?
It's a
huge problem.
Yeah, it is. And people can embrace this or not, but I tend to look at these things as back to that notion of Adolf Bastian, that we have these stories that come from various time periods where the world was a certain way. And so the behavior of the people always gets attributed to the behavior of the deity, right? And so what we really know from those texts is that the people who wrote them went and did these things to right? So if it says, you know, if there's an account in the Old Testament and it says the Jews went into this area and killed every man, woman, child, and cow in the area.
Yeah.
If and sheep, the pagan sheep, baby.
Those evil sheep, man. They're horrible.
If that corresponds to something that actually happened, an historical event, all we know is that Jews went into that town and killed every man, woman, child, cow, and sheep. Yeah. Right, as far as if God told them to do it or not, we have no idea if there's even a God. And if there is a God, if it's the God of Israel, and if there is a God of Israel, if he actually told them to do that or not. How many people throughout history, like Benny Hinn, how many people, even as an evangelical, how many people do you know who claim that God told them? I mean, people all the time are in jail. God told me to drown my two babies in the tub. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like a lot of people do sick shit.
Amen.
Saying God told him to do it. So there's no guarantee that this is the behavior of the deity, but just because a text says it is. And we're still bound by this idea that if the text says God ordered it, then what kind of God is this? And my answer is that what kind of people is this? Right?
What goes on there?
Because to me, the word God, and this is where I was going in terms of the Reconstruction, the word God is a technology. It's an algorithm. And it's an algorithm for accessing and sustaining forms of empathic consciousness. And what I mean by that is God to me is that which is not you, but also you in the universe. When I go back to this quantum stuff about consciousness being primary and connectivity, putting those two concepts together, God consciousness is a way for people to do two things at once, feel immediately, intimately infused and connected to the creative consciousness of the cosmos. And two, move into an orientation where they're not just in service of their own egos, but they are in service of one another in the bonds of love, right? That service to capital O other God is the template by which one starts to understand service to little o other, which is every being one comes across. Right. And Jesus even says this in that weird ass book, Revelation, when did we ignore you, Lord? And he says, as you did to the least of these, you did to me. So this very notion of that every person you meet on the street, every interaction we have is an opportunity for us to practice this notion of doing nothing that isn't compassionate, life affirming and wellness generating. And to me, it's as simple as that, right? Like every choice that I make. Yeah. Can I manifest this kind of other awareness into the world when I interact with people of color, when I interact with people of various genders, when I interact with people of various faiths, when I interact with homeless people, when I interact with white evangelical Christians, right?
Trump voters.
Can I treat them with compassionate, life-affirming, wellness-generating choices that emphasize service to other, humility, gratitude, and connectivity? And to me, the science is showing that this is the nature of the cosmos. And so, like, I'm trying to replace all of those old systems of thinking of punishment and reward. God's going to get you if you do it wrong. God's going to give you a mansion in heaven if you do it right. And
golden toilet,
rivers of milk and honey, all that shit. You know what I mean? Like, all that external justification for behavior. I'm trying to find ways to authentically internalize it and seeing God consciousness as exactly what I said, as a technology, a very old technology that we developed, a linguistic technology to trigger these states of empathic awareness. I'll say one more thing about it real quick. There's this guy named Andrew Newberg. We talked about this yesterday, who studies neurotheology, and he's a fascinating dude. And he hooks people up to brain scans and like studies them when they're praying, when they're meditation. He gets all this amazing work. And one of the things he just found out is that the word they use for this consciousness that they say is sort of fundamental to the universe and is everywhere and nowhere at once. The word they use for that is non-locality. So the consciousness that's in my brain right now, the consciousness that's bouncing back and forth in this conversation, that's local consciousness. It's localized in my bread. My head's full of dough, making associations, you know, coming up with ideas and sharing them with you and your audience. Then you have a response or whatever, right? That's local consciousness. But non-local consciousness is this thing that the quantum physicists are talking about. This is this consciousness that doesn't exist anywhere. It doesn't sit on a throne, you know, worrying about if you prayed the right way and if you've offered the right time. Yeah, what you're wearing to church, if, you know, if you're a Buddhist or not. It's non-locality, which is, again, it's everywhere and nowhere at once. And what Newberg was able to find in this recent research, I don't even know if he's published it yet, is that he took groups of people, three or more, right, and had them do these tuning exercises. And anytime you go to church, if you look back through the history of meditation classes, of church services, liturgy, they never start with the message, right? They never start with the teaching. There's always a song first, a prayer, a sort of call to service, whether Muslim, yeah. Jew, Christian,
focuses
Buddhist.
People on this, yeah. Plane of whatever, spirituality, exactly. Or resonance or whatever it is.
It takes all the various individual consciousnesses in the room and tunes them on the same
frequency,
yeah. And this actually, you can check people's brain scans before and after, and they're all over the place when they enter the room. And then once they start with the praise songs and the hands go in the air or liturgy or whatever it is, all of their brain chemistry and all of their brain waves kind of go to the same place. And what Newberg said is that this creates a sort of antenna, right? And this is weird, but Newberg's not a believer, right? He's just a neurologist, right? And this creates a kind of signal antenna, that collection, to, you know, where two or more are gathered,
hey.
There all be also, right? What happens at that point is it triggers the opportunity for one member of the group or more, but at least one member of the group to have this direct encounter with this non-local consciousness. They don't quite know how it works. They don't quite know what it is,
what
right? But somehow they figured out that when a group of people gather together with this intent, tune their energy towards the one thing, one person tends to end up with this profound transformative encounter with non-locality, right? So, and then the group takes that as proof that the teachings are true, right? And so in a Pentecostal church, when someone starts speaking in tongues, when someone comes to the front, you know, at an altar call, right? And so the group then takes that as proof of the movement of the Spirit. See, the Lord's here, and the Lord's doing work because he's changing hearts and minds. But the problem is, like you said, that happens when you're at biker rallies too, right? You can go, exactly. You brought that up. You're like, hey,
you're listening to AC/DC.
Listening to AC/DC, throwing
having
a few,
great time,
having a great time,
down.
Throwing a few down, a little barbecue, right? And then so that could be a spiritual experience, right?
That isn't church though, Andrew. Yeah. I mean, come on.
See, I would say it is. Yeah, it's ecclesia.
Exactly.
That's community. Yeah.
Exactly.
That's the root of the word church is community.
Exactly.
Yeah. And in authentic community, people's walls come down and they start being more vulnerable with one another and they start really sharing experiences with one another. And that is the key to,
that is the key
to this connection, to this sort of unilateral consciousness that we all share. And it creates these empathic bonds with one another. And so it's a long answer, I know, but reconstruction is these folks have set themselves up as the truth tellers and the ones who are
the arbiters
of and
exactly.
You almost feel like we don't, like they're the experts, right? It's almost like telling a dentist they don't know how to work on teeth, but it's different than that, isn't it? Because these people are experts in things that they've made all the rule. We can't verify anything that they're saying. If a dentist has a really bad idea on how to work on teeth, we can prove it, right? By looking at the data.
I don't want to be the guy he's drilling on.
Yeah, but Christians, we have no, like, they're just like, you got to take our word for it. You'll find out after you die if we're right or not.
Well, somebody was asking on the Exvangelical Facebook page, you know, what do you do with Christians who come up to you and say, you know, God really said to me that such and such, and God was leading me here and there, and God did this and God did that, and how do you even know that that's even true? What do you say to that without sounding like a huge douchebag?
Yeah.
It's interesting to go back to your point, too, about ecclesia and community. When I was having dinner with Mike last night, this is the guy that I was – he was our associate pastor when the church closed down and everything else. He, after that experience and everything went south, he quit going to church for about 5 years.
Wow.
And he was telling me last night, though, he went back to church – because he realized principally that he needed community. He didn't really have many friends, just full stop.
Yeah.
And he thought, well, what's the best place for me to be? back in church. Now, the interesting part about that is he needed that piece of community, as you said. It's hugely important. But he started going to a church, and it was all negative, negative, browbeating.
Yeah.
He's like, his antenna was tuned to that, you know, because if that was his backstory, like us.
Yeah.
Being browbeaten by the preacher every Sunday.
Yeah.
You know, you're not doing this, you're not blah, blah, blah. And the Bible says you're not. And then he quit going to that church, found another church. And he said, now here's the interesting thing is that every sermon he hears every Sunday, he's heard it all before.
Yeah.
We've all heard it. There's only a limited range, really, of what preachers can say. Let's be honest.
Yeah.
Whatever text you're reading from. And he said, but the difference is this guy is at least positive.
Wow.
That's the best he can say.
So that's the best he can say. Yeah. The guy's positive. So, yeah, then like, it goes into, like, New Age hippie Jesus, exactly. Which is still problematic. It's better.
It's better than the browbeating guy.
Yeah.
But at this other church, he kind of came around to the point, where, and I said to him, it sounds to me like you've gone as far as you can go in this church.
Mm.
Why are you there? I'm
yeah.
not being funny, but why are you there? And he said, basically, it's the community piece.
Mm-hmm.
He met his now wife there. He was single. He met his wife. They're married and real happy. So that's a positive, I guess. And the other thing was he gets to play music.
Yeah.
And he's a guitar player, you know, and so he gets to lead worship and stuff, and he's enjoying that piece. So it's like, okay. But you're getting nothing other
right.
than you being able to play and you have a couple of friends there and you met your spouse and that's it. He's not learning anything. But what's interesting is that when he and I were working together, we pushed each other a lot. We were reading a lot of progressive Christianity, you know, Christian authors like Brian McLaren and Donald Miller and other people, Rob Bell. But now he's completely gone off that whole line. Because I said, do you ever sit down with the pastor and challenge him on these sermons? He's, and why don't you say, nope.
No.
He says, I don't want to change anything. I don't say anything. I just play the music and I go home and I'm just content to just kind of float along down the stream.
I wonder how many people that are in church are like that, that have just walked away from any of their real core beliefs, including leadership. I've met pastors in the day that when I was leaving the pastorate, I met a lot of other pastors that were like, man, I stopped believing 20 years ago.
Yeah,
just keep the gig, man. Like, it's a gig, you know? It's like,
it's a job.
Punch the clock, tell the flock you know.
Punch the clock, tell the flock.
Tell the flock, yeah. Tell them all they're going to burn and then cash the check, baby. You know, and I mean, there are many people that aren't like that. I don't want to suggest that.
Well, I know, it's a cynical view, but there must be some. But I had to wonder about that. And then the guy that I just had breakfast with has gone the other route.
He's super
happy, clappy, back into Jesus. He's 100%. And, you know, he came out of a story of botched surgeries, and he went down a real dark path and got into drugs and alcohol, got back out of that, got into rehab a few years back. And part of that rehab experience was plugging into the church and going full steam ahead.
Yeah.
So that's his lifeline now. So again, it comes back to this thing of after the deconstruction. What's fascinating to me is the different paths that people go down. So you got Marvin, he's gone down the happy, clappy, 100% Jesus evangelical route. Mike is just kind of floating down the stream.
Yeah.
Not going to say anything, not going to rock the boat. You and me, we just walked away from it all and
said, the whole thing.
Now we're questioning it and asking a lot of tough things. We're not getting a good answer.
Yeah.
Or we didn't back in the day.
Certainly didn't.
Well, and your story about talking to the professor, you want to tell that one where you went and talked to the guy? It's our mutual friend that we both studied under Bible College, and he was very uncomfortable.
Yeah, you know, I'll tell that in a second. But I was going to say about the other thing too is that Karen Armstrong, who's a former nun and a biblical scholar, has written a lot of books on God and on religion, and she says something interesting. She says, "Never trust an interpretation of Scripture that doesn't end in charity." And don't forget, let me tell you the story about that professor, but this idea that we were talking about this last night, what a lot of people do, and all of us do it, right? I mean, all of us do it. The liberals that I know do it, the Buddhists that I know do it, and the evangelicals that I know do it, right? But since we're talking about evangelicals, your consciousness, your individual consciousness, right? You get introduced to things, and like, again, things like inerrancy, inspiration, young earth, none of these things are in the biblical text. Just somebody that when you were either 4 or 5 or 11 or 35 years old, when you were a baby Christian, somebody in the pastorate or somewhere told you these things were true and that you had to believe them without question. And then you accepted them and they went into a thing in your brain.
Yeah, a vault or something.
Yeah. And this you were just told this. You have no way of knowing if any of that is legitimate. Yeah. Somebody just told you, just like somebody told that person that told you. You have no idea if they're correct or not. Just goes into the vault and anybody who questions those things gets attacked. And you're a liberal, you're God, Satan, you know.
Yeah.
But what that person has actually done is taking their own limited consciousness, their own limited way of seeing and experiencing the world, and rubber stamped it as the way the deity sees the world. They've literally done the most idolatrous thing you can do, which is equated their own way of seeing and making associations with the way God is. They see it as a one-to-one correspondence. God thinks like this. God talks like this. God wants exactly this. God wants you to do this. God, I got it figured out. Yeah. What God wants is every, I already know exactly what God is, what God wants, what God says, what God wants for you, what he thinks about faggots, what he thinks about, you know, the whole thing. I got the whole thing down, right? And in reality, I've just rubber stamped my conscious associations, my phobias, my fears, my anxieties, the things that I've been told that I believe to be true, the things that I've experienced that are moving to me, even genuinely so, I've woven that all together into this notion that I call orthodoxy or the biblical truth or the word of God.
Biblical worldview.
Yeah, right.
That's a phrase that gets thrown around.
Yeah, and now I go insist that other people accept that without question or somehow they are doing something against God. And the thing is, you should never trust a human brain. Especially your own, right? The good thing about science is it's constantly questioning itself, right? It's not that we should all just do what scientists tell us, but the good thing about it is that it's self-refuting. It's built a mechanism in that says, don't just take my word for it. Go test the thing out and see if it's accurate. And if it isn't, let's refine it to make it more so.
That's the scientific method.
That's the scientific method. And the biblical worldview, not only with the fact that revelation ended ever, which is idiotic, but the idea that interpretation is codified into these small camps of orthodoxy, and that if one doesn't accept all of this extra biblical associations without question, that one is now in danger of hellfire. It externalizes everything, including natural consequences. So we were talking about earlier today about someone we knew, and I've had some friends here in town. I struggled with weight issues earlier in my life, and I've known some people 400, 500, 600 pounds, right? And we were talking about some of these folks, and they struggle in their lives, right? And they have a lot of pain, they have a lot of anxiety, they have a lot of heart issues and joint issues, and they can't do things with other people. They can't. We're going kayaking this weekend. They can't go. They can't even get down on the boat. And they have really difficult, really sad lives. Now, if I was like, you're committing the sin of gluttony and the Lord's going to punish you in hellfire because of gluttony, you know what I mean? There's still this notion of an external punishment. If somebody, to me, it doesn't matter if somebody's gay. It doesn't matter if they're married. It doesn't matter if they're monogamous. It matters if they're authentic and compassionate and loving and life-affirming and honest in their relationships. What we know to be true, universally so, is that whatever the parameters of your relationship are, if you're in some polyamorous relationship, if you're a lesbian couple, if you're a conservative Christian fundamentalist couple, if you aren't living an authentic, loving, compassionate, honest relationship, that relationship isn't going to thrive. Whether you stay married forever or whether you're just casually dating, even if you're just picking up chicks at a bar and going home and having sex, right? If you're not honest, compassionate, loving, and authentic, even in those interactions, you're going to live a sad and lonely life, right? And so I started trying to break this stuff back away from the orthodoxies and the sort of over-interpretive tendencies that we've had, and what's the core element here. And I do think that people thrive when they're authentic and loving with one another in relationship. So I think that's a God thing, whatever that means, right? But I won't take it further than that. I won't take it further into he wants you to be gay, he wants you to be married, he wants you to be a virgin until you're married. All of that is cultural conditioning. All of that has to do with controlling women's bodies and binary gender and meeting the needs of industrial civilization. It has to do with all this other stuff. Yeah, it has nothing to do with any of the rest of that. Back in seminary, the question you asked, I would ask these questions too. And I did it not because I was trying to cause trouble, not because I had doubt, but because I thought, I'm going to be a theologian. I'm going to be either in a classroom or in the pulpit working with people with these issues. And so I want to prepare myself for folks that come in with these kind of questions, because I thought part of the ministry is going to be like doing funerals and weddings and helping people. But part of it's going to be answering people's really difficult theological questions.
Talking to people, looking at their doubts and questions.
Now, I will say
you
this.
You can't have them.
Now that I'm a teacher, now that I'm a professor, I really value my office time, and I always have lots of grading work to do. So if I did have a student that came to my office constantly. It was just like, hey, man, what about this for 5 hours? I would probably lose my patience with the kid, too. Yeah, so, yeah. On this professor's defense, like maybe he was like, enough already with this guy.
Had enough.
Yeah, he won't go. I got work to do here. I got to get home.
You got great papers.
Man. But the interaction was interesting. And this is a guy that invested a lot in me. He was really kind to me.
Yeah, he did to me, too.
But this interaction was telling. And I was asking, we were just having this conversation about, it had started with something that happened with another faculty member. And I think I mentioned this on that last broadcast when he was talking about the difference between contradictions and paradoxes and how all other religions have contradictions, but Christianity only has paradoxes. And I was like, okay, what do you mean?
Special pleading, isn't it?
And I was like, what do you mean by that? And he was like, well, paradox is a contradiction that you believe ultimately resolves itself. And I was like, wait, bro. Like, you should work for like Nike.
This is a word salad.
Yeah, man. This is complete gibberish, right? And so I took that concept to this faculty member and was trying to go, wait a minute, this is like a smoke and mirrors deal here. Yeah,
it's
like
a bait and switch here.
Yeah, I want to be able to. And he was like, well, Andrew, he was kind of pushing back on like, you just kind of, this is just how the faith is. And I was like, well, man, is it though? And also really? Like, I'm anticipating having folks sitting in my office someday asking me these questions and I want to be able to answer them for them or at least help them go find the answers.
And there shouldn't be any question that you can't ask.
Yeah.
Right?
And then the guy got really mobster with me. He took his glasses off. He kind of rubbed his eyes and he leaned forward with this like, I'm going to say this one time and this is over. Right? And he was like, Andy, you're getting dangerously close to something that is not a safe thing for us to talk about. And he was like, I decided these things were true long ago. I'm comfortable with that decision and I don't wish to talk about it anymore. He was basically like, back off now. Yeah, or else. And I don't know what the or else would have been. Like, if he would have like hit me with a stick or something or asked me to leave his office.
Under my desk.
Yeah, yeah. Hit a button, and I like the chute. Yeah.
Mr.
Like
Burns
Mr. Burns. Yeah. Excellent. I'm crawling through the hole. Yeah. Like Homer. Yeah. So I thought maybe that would have been the deal, but it really freaked me out because it gave me this notion of like over the line, there's this off limits area. And for my brain, I was like, oh, well, shit. Whoa. That's all I want to focus on now. If there's an area.
Now you told me there's.
If there's a door in the church. That I'm not supposed to open, then I got to kick that sumbitch open, right? Man,
kick
there's
it
no.
Down.
And it got me thinking about this idea of compassion. Christians are so worried about, God's judgment and God, and if you don't do this, you're going to go to hell. And if I don't share this with you, God's going to be mad at me for not trying to win you over to the gospel. This whole idea of converting people to the team and punishment based orientation, I still think. So much of that is contingent. So much of that is our own projection. This militant American Christianity we see now, all in support of the current president.
Global culture wars.
Yeah.
We've got to win the culture wars.
At all costs. A simple way for me to look at that equation is this. I want to be the most compassionate, life-affirming, and wellness-generating. I think in psychology, when we're looking at harm reduction, right? And harm reduction is like you take a person who's an addict or in an abusive situation or homeless or mental illness or our friend who has, my friend who has severe obesity, and you start thinking about what's the next choice they can make to limit the amount of harm they're doing to themselves. Just right now, today, like what's a little step? And what's another step the next day and another step the next day?
You can't go the whole distance away.
How do we reduce harm day by day? And to where we stop the inflammation and then can actually start moving towards healing once the person's at a crisis. But it's these harm reduction models. And to me, that's God work, that taking people who are suffering and finding real, proven, practical ways to minimize that suffering. Now, as a therapist, and I'm not one, but if I were, as a counselor, and I am, I still consider myself a pastor in a weird way.
Exactly,
If I'm counseling somebody and it seems to me that, like you mentioned this friend who really is like this former addict friend who has found a way to have community in church and have meaning and cohesion in his life, even though he doesn't really agree with most of the finer points of the theology. If I were a therapist, I would need to be open to, do I have clients where church would be a good thing for them? And what kind of church? Do I have clients where, AA would be a good thing for them? Do I have clients who, maybe Buddhist meditation would be a good thing for them? Do I have clients who just need to go hiking in the fucking woods more, right? I don't want to set myself, create a notion where I think any healing model is off limits. The problem with evangelicals and with biblical theism is not that it has nothing to offer. It is a 1900 year long meditation on the unitary nature of consciousness. It's filled with all kinds of problematic ideas, especially the way evangelicals interpret it.
But the way they've acted out.
But there's a mechanism there, especially in the wisdom tradition. There's a mechanism. There are things within these texts. This is why you and I went back to them for so many years. There are things there that are beautiful and insightful about human nature and the human spirit. They just have to be read with an inclination, not towards this kind of dopey reductionistic literalism, but from a bit of a distance as texts about other people's encounters with the divine. This isn't new here. The American transcendentalists, you know, so Thoreau and Emerson and those guys, they were like, look, religion for us is reading this book about somebody else's encounter with the transcendence. And what the hell is that? Like some guy named Moses, some guy named Peter gets to meet God face to face. But my religion is just reading this book about how that happened. Like, I want to meet God face to face too. Right. And so their thing was, I want an experience with God. I don't want to just read about somebody else's experience with God on Sunday morning. And they were like, how do you do that? And their thought was nature. This is what Walden, this is what all that stuff's about. Yeah, going back to nature. Yeah, the romantic poets, the direct encounter.
Walden Pond. And all that. Right. I find God out in the forest.
Absolutely.
Sitting by the side of the lake.
This was church for them. And I'm inclined to agree. I get much more direct encounter with spirit when I'm in like the Olympic forest than I do when I'm like a Baptist church or
sitting
something.
Sitting in the church. Well, it's interesting too, going back to what you were saying about this biblical worldview thing.
Yeah.
Something I was thinking about. I used to teach one of the modules was on this subject of biblical worldview.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking that's the dynamic of the hermeneutic, the way we read the text. Because what my argument used to be was you take a narrative of scripture and it's inspired interpretation of an event.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, to read it that way, that's the evangelical conservative literalist kind of hermeneutic, isn't it?
Yeah.
You say, look, the book of Jonah, he lived 3 days in a whale.
Yeah.
It's a
great fish.
A great fish, not a whale, because it's in the Bible and it's inspired and it's true.
Yeah.
It has, that story has to be historically true.
Yeah.
You know, and then you're again painting yourself into that corner. And I used to say, well, what we need to do is understand that this is how God sees the world. And the way you need to see the world is the same way.
So yeah.
The miraculous is explained as God's intervention in the human nature. And that's one way to make that text accessible, as you said.
Yeah.
Why am I reading about ancient Corinth?
Yeah.
What the hell? 2,000 years ago?
How does that help me in my
day-to-day? Israel wandered in the desert. But then I would try to extrapolate that out and say, well, this is kind of this making this biblical worldview your own and try to apply it that way. But now I'm thinking that could take you down some weird paths for sure, because is every event interpreted through this lens of God's involvement in the world? And then, like you say, when you challenge people on that worldview level, they get really angry, or they can. We all had those encounters, I'm sure.
Yeah.
You were telling stories about that last night.
Yeah, man. And, you know, when I think about Jonah, it makes me angry. And this goes to, like, my friend you were asking me to talk about a little bit in her experience. The same thing. Just really grown up in an abusive, terrifying environment and just, afraid and afraid of God, afraid of the church, afraid of the Bible, and just living in this constant. Or
was it a fundamentalist?
Yeah. But, you know, so alternating between this kind of terror of the transcendence and of the community and her own family, and then this kind of overflowing confidence that comes from one who feels they're redeemed as well. You know what I mean? Yeah. So that other you're side of the evangelical righteous. Where you're like, yeah, all the rest of you are going to burn, but I'm good. My name's in the book of life.
I got my golden ticket.
Yeah. And we talk about that stuff all the time, because she's still, what's interesting is she still carries this kind of fundamentalist reading. So she's like, why would God put a guy in a whale for 3 days? And, you know, and I was like, you're still reading these texts like you were taught to read them. And she reads other myths this way. So she'll go read like Irish mythology. And it's like, why would a leprechaun turn a guy into it? And I'm like, no, wait a minute. You're still have this kind of fundamentalist view of reading mythology. And we have to shed that and understand story for how it works. When I look at the Jonah myth, and we talked about this last time, anything in the Old Testament, this is a Hebrew Bible, and so the first thing I'm going to do is not go to Christian interpretation. I'm going to go look at how Jews understand their own text. And this is a text written in captivity in Babylon, right, in code, because they didn't want their Babylonian captors to understand what was written. And so we have this idea of, like, if it says a guy lived in a fish. And the people who wrote the book literally are telling you, we wrote a guy lived in a fish for 3 days as code for something else we're trying to communicate, but we didn't want to say outwardly what that was. Like, if they genuinely said this is what Talmud and Midrash is, it's the oral Torah. It's the key to unlocking what those texts are about. But even without going into that, just a cursory reading of Jonah, right? And you, I took your, hey, your inductive Bible class. You're my teacher on Jonah, baby. I can't believe I passed that class. I'm telling you, man, you had a lot of compassion.
D minus.
D minus. A on the outline, D on the speech.
Exactly. Squeak through.
But when I read Jonah, I see a couple things in it that whether or not a guy lived in a fish, whether or not any of it ever happened, I see two or three things that are fascinating to me. One is that the deity, again, has this message of love for all, that there isn't a chosen people, there isn't a ranking system, there isn't inside and outside, and Nineveh to the Jew, when you understand biblical history, Nineveh is not, this is not a good place
not
for
good
Jews.
Place.
Yeah, the Assyrian Empire.
The worst place they could go to.
These are the folks that carried off the 10 northern kingdoms into slavery, and they absorbed them. They didn't do it like Babylon.
They're just, too.
I mean, it was a massacre, right? Yeah. Raised Jerusalem. I mean, it was a real. So,
was a mess.
So to be told, go tell these people I love them would be a bit like telling a modern evangelical to go to like, you know, some kind of crazy liberal LGBTQ gay pride parade,
exactly.
And like, and not be like, God loves you and wants you to repent, stop being
otherwise
gay.
You're gonna burn.
Yeah, otherwise you're gonna burn. But to be like, you're loved just the way you are, right? Like go
that's
to the most non-Christian, Christian hating, pagan, gay, you know, orgy you can find and walk right into the middle of it and be like, the Lord, you know, God love, you know, God is love, and if you're in love, then God is in you, and that's that, right? Jonah doesn't want to do this because he's like, fuck that. They're sinners. They're pagan pigs. We're better than them. They don't deserve this message, right? So then, you know, he gets tossed in the fish. And then he goes, all right, I'll do it. And then he goes in there and he goes, 40 days and you're all going to die. So he gives the standard evangelical message. Oh, I'll go give a message to those people at Saturday market. I'll stand out there on my megaphone and tell them
on my soapbox.
Yeah, there was a guy at the Saturday market, this big market here in Portland, right? This outdoor market every Saturday and Sunday. And he was the classic evangelical. He's got the sign. He's got the megaphone.
Turn
and the gays and the evolutionists. And for some reason, vegetarians are going to burn. I don't even know what the hell that
really?
Was about. Yeah, but he had the
what's
whole thing
against vegans?
Lesbians and vegetarians and yucky, you know. And I remember walking up to the guy once and I tried to engage him and I was like, hey man, I'm a seminary grad and like I think I was even a believer still at the time. And I was like, I just had a question for you. Like, you know, I get what you're doing and I get, you know, what you're down. And I was like, have you ever come down here and been like, what a beautiful Saturday afternoon. Look at all these people at the market here with their dogs. Look at all these people playing this amazing music. Look at all these arts and crafts that people are making. Look at this
community.
Look at this, the food and the smells and the community and the children, and all the different craft and artwork. The God I worship is the source of all of this beauty and all of this togetherness and all of this, you know, creativity and all of this wonderful food. Like the God I worship is the thing that is, underlies all of it and is responsible for all of that art and all of that expression and all of those happy children and all those dogs. Right. And the guy was like, get the hell away from me, you commie fag. You know what I mean? The guy was like, what the hell
damn
are you
liberal.
Telling me? Yeah, you damn liberal.
You're
going to burn too. I'm here to tell these faggots what time it is, you know? And I was like, bro, like he literally got super violent with me and was like trying to push me away. And I was like, hey, just alternate it. I'm not saying go hippie Jesus on it. Have you ever said to these folks, what do you think these people would do? If you were like, hey man, cool mohawk, you know, that's beautiful, you know, the way to express yourself, you know what I mean? Like, this chill.
That guy's
going
to burn too.
That guy's going to burn too. And if he's a vegetarian, it's even worse, man. And
what if he's a vegetarian with a mohawk?
With a mohawk. I'll light him on fire right now to save the Lord. Yeah, and he's gay.
Mohawk guy is a vegan. He's, that's a special place in hell for that guy.
But, you know, Karen Armstrong's thing about, like, reject any interpretation that doesn't end in charity. I always had this vision of getting to heaven. Right. You know, because if your name's in the book of life, your acts aren't going to be judged. Right. You just get let in
ticket. Because
you said the code word. Right. But if you're us, then the book gets opened and our acts are all the things we've looked at.
All the things you did.
Now, here's something idiotic, because all the things you did aren't the reason you get into heaven. It's only the accepting of Christ as Lord and Savior. Right. And
believing
so what?
All the right things.
So you're looking at this book and it's like, oh, well, you did all these things. So now you don't get to get in. So that's weird, because that's not how you get in to begin with.
It's
right. So even within the explanation of the metaphysics of what happens when one gets to these so-called gates is completely inconsistent. I don't know if you've thought about that ever, but
interesting. Well, I've played with a scenario whereby the guy dies and stands in front of Peter.
Yeah.
And Peter says, why should I let you into heaven?
Yeah.
And the guy says, well, I went to church, but did you speak in tongues?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, no, you're off to hell.
You're off. You're out of there.
Or did you believe in the pre-tribulational rapture? No. Yeah. Anything.
Any of that stuff.
You didn't believe
transubstantiation?
This.
Ooh, exactly. You're out of here.
You're gone. Yeah. You know, and so that you have to take that scenario to a logical. That's what would happen.
You believe in the infallibility of the Pope?
You believe Moses wrote the Pentateuch?
Yeah.
No, you're going to hell.
By the way, according to the church, the institution that actually canonized and handed us this New Testament that all these folks are basing this on, which is Rome. Yeah, none of these Protestants are going to go to hell. Every evangelical is going to hell anyway because they don't believe in the infallibility of the Pope and all that stuff. So it's a moot point.
Exactly.
Like the very institution that gave us the New Testament is the Roman Catholics, and we can spend a whole episode talking about them. But I always envision a scenario of, so this thing I've been trying to say, and I don't perfectly live it. Obviously, I'm trying to, but using the best science we have, using my knowledge as a mythologist and a professor of religious studies to not do a cafeteria style pick and choose like a Unitarian church. Mm-hmm. Yeah, throw a little Buddhism here, a little Hinduism here, throw it all in a pot, see how it tastes. But try to really negotiate what is the human soul, whatever that is, the human animal as an animal that has the capacity and the desire for spiritual contemplation. What is it? What are the core things that feed it? Like I was saying with the human body. And then I can look at all the various ways people have done that through the years. But we also have to look at the emerging science and put it all together and go, what are we looking at here? Right. And I keep coming back to this same equation about do nothing that isn't compassionate, life affirming, and wellness generating.
Yeah, three kind of core values.
Yeah.
Well, and I think.
And if I stand before the pearly gates and I'm told you're not allowed in because you have a higher standard of righteousness than the deity does. Like, I mean, imagine being told, you were too nice to people. You were too compassionate.
Yeah, you weren't nice.
You weren't enough of a dick to lesbians.
You need to go down to that market.
Yeah. You need to be with the other guy, right? Yelling at everybody, right? And so if I, I don't want to go to hell. Do you want to go? I mean, if there's a hell and it's where you burn and suffer, I don't want to be there. But if not being there means I have to have a lower standard of compassion, that I have to be crueler and more judgmental and more dismissive and more of a douchebag to other humans and other animals and other living creatures, because I've been given dominion. Yeah, yeah.
Because, the church has been horrifically bad on the environment.
Yeah, which is idiotic because stewardship doesn't apparently mean the same thing to me as it does to you, right?
Yeah. As we're kind of wrapping it up, I know you got stuff to do. It seems to me kind of summarizing our reconstruction after deconstruction.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm hearing a couple of themes come out in what you're saying is the kind of synchronizing between the material and the spiritual is hugely important. And obviously that's not a new concept by any stretch. Mm. But one thing I've realized in my life, I think in the last few years, that because my experiences in evangelicalism were so bad and traumatic, I've walled off the spiritual side of me.
Yeah.
And I focused on the theology and it's all bullshit and all that.
Mm-hmm.
But now I'm going, actually, I'm hearing what you're saying. I'm going, I need to explore the spirituality piece, whatever that means.
Whatever that means.
I think you're finding those connections going back to the cave art and stuff where humanity has been doing that ubiquitously across the world, across thousands and thousands of years. There's this sense that we need to be in connection with the material as well as the spiritual, whatever that means. I'm thinking my sister Valerie, for example, she does this meditation podcast every morning.
Wow.
And that's hugely helpful because she's walked away from the church, but she feels like that's my spirituality. It centers me. It grounds me. It's helped me with confidence and a lot of other things. My crippling self-esteem.
Yeah. Yeah.
And talking social anxiety. All the things that were laid on her by the church. So that's her way of being grounded and finding that spirituality. So, those are hugely helpful things, I think.
Yeah, man. There's a guy named John Shelby Sprong who talks about walking with people into the mystery of God. And I kind of see my role as doing that. And it's problematic still because I don't quite know what it means.
But what does that mean? What does it look like?
It's still fraught with all of this. Like even getting close to that idea gets you exposed to all these mental patients with all these bad ideas and all this
crazy
hate. Yeah, and you're going to burn. And you're even getting close to that word again. makes my liberal friends think I'm falling back into the Jesus thing, and they get all freaked out.
You're a secret fundamentalist.
Yeah, and then my Christian friends are like, what kind of new age guru crap is this guy made? So even approaching those terms again freaks a lot of people out. It's really hard. But yeah, I think it's two things, man, as we're wrapping up. One is it's encountering the very old. So how I'm doing it is going further back to elemental beginnings of our species' attempts to reckon with these things. Because it's before a lot of these, a lot of this differentiation happened.
Put all the labels on. You can strip the labels away.
And we talked last night about the Council of Trent, something that has happened since the 1600s or so, is this notion of the split in the sensibilities. And the university system reinforces this. And roughly it goes like this. The church was killing scientists that were coming up with, the earth is in the center of the universe. The universe is older than 10,000 years old. So they would put these guys in jail and light them on fire for saying this stuff, right? And that wasn't a sustainable thing. And so a sort of agreement was made. And they basically said to the physical scientists, if you guys focus on like rocks and dirt, like we're going to let you focus on material things and go study them, right? As long as you leave consciousness and the things of spirit to us.
That's our realm.
Right? So you guys, right? And those guys took the deal because they were like, we're tired of getting burned alive and thrown in dungeons.
You don't have a lot of options there.
And so we'll do it, right? But two problems came of this. And again, the university system still complies with this. Two problems emerge from this. One is the church didn't keep their end of the bargain. The church has all kinds of things that they want to say and impose about the physical world. They care about politics. They care about abortion. They care about marriage. They care about resource management, like you said, but the environment. They argue with you if the physical scientists tell you the earth is millions of years old. So they don't.
Contradicts the Bible.
Yeah, they didn't leave. They didn't say, you guys go study the physical things and we'll leave that alone. They completely glommed onto it and are still mercilessly attacking it. But the second part of the problem is that the materialists kept their part of the bargain. So the physical scientists have become this set of principles and ways of thinking that specifically bars any notion of spirit or even supernatural, which is a bad phrase because what I'm talking about is something absolutely woven into the human animal, into the nature of the universe itself. So it's not supernatural at all. It's something that's fundamental to the nature of material and of the natural. And so even the category supernatural is problematic because it's this Aristotelian sort of carving off of these ideas and putting them in this container over there.
But that's where the research is leading them.
But the that's the problem. The research is leading them to that stuff.
It's inexorable. It's happening.
And so, I trust it in the hands of quantum physicists more than I trust it in the hands of these child molesting priests or these doom and gloom pastors that have had this, that have been the self-professed arbiters of this stuff for the past several thousand years.
But God told them. That's the problem.
Yeah.
God told me that I needed to do this, that, or the other. God told me the earth's 6,000 years old.
But people are leaving churches in droves. Nobody in Europe goes to church anymore. I mean, there's this resurgence of these right-wing movements that are happening in Europe. Yeah. And so there's a lot of kind of nationalism and white supremacy and that's getting tucked in with a spiritual revivalist. But if it weren't for that, and that's in the States too, but if it weren't for that, no one's going to church anymore. I mean, you go to Europe and church people, the churches there are like things people visit when they're doing
Museums. Notre Dame.
They're museums.
I love living in Europe because of that very reason. Yeah. I go to cathedrals every chance I get because it's a living slice of the past. It's 1,000 years old.
Yeah.
It's an amazing piece of architecture and it's a statement of a lot of things, wealth and status and privilege and all kind of theology. There you see the paintings on the wall, the statues.
There's a church called St. Bavo in Harlem that we went to that is actually unbelievable for a couple of reasons. It started building it in 1000 AD and then completed in like 1300. And two things real quick that blew my mind about the church. One is the main stained glass window is completely pagan. It's not a biblical, it's a big blue window with a feminized moon figure. It's the moon kind of feminized and it's spitting out these rose petals that are falling out onto the ground and onto the earth. It's completely not any kind of biblical imagery I've ever seen. And then also at the church, it's where they did scientific experiments, calculated the curvature of the earth first. Was at this church, and there's three or four other things that happened there. And they have, and as you go around to the various halls, they have like stuff that explains all of this. And it was so beautiful to see a place, a house of worship that not only was Christ-centered, but completely like involved in things like scientific experimentation and completely comfortable with this pagan iconography and being like, no, this is all integrated stuff. It's that split in the sensibilities that has these things warring with one another. Exactly. One has to choose between a kind of dead mechanistic universe or one that's run by this capricious, homophobic, misogynistic maniac, right? And those are not pleasing choices.
Exactly.
Either one.
Neither one's good.
Yeah. And neither one is really accurate according to the emerging data.
Yeah. That's an important piece, isn't it? Again, back to the reconstruction piece.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is charting a course that's going to work rather than being forced to accept binary oppositions all the time. Because as you said, that's what we were raised in this evangelical culture. It's black and white, sacred, secular, good, evil, God, Satan. Everything's in these dualistic terms. And we're like, we have to choose. We have to choose. What do we believe? It's all true. It's all false. And you know, evolution's all bullshit. And it's creationism all the way. 6,000 years. And you go down that line. And you're like, well, where do you end up with that? You end up in this reductionistic thing where you're stuck in this box. And how do you get out of it? And do you want to be in that box?
Challenging your own thinking, man. Yeah. Not just challenging the pagans out there, but my message to evangelicals is go back to that Jonah book and stop worrying about if a guy lived in a fish and look at what's happening there. You have the servant of God is the biggest asshole in the book, right? Everyone else is cool.
Yeah.
The pagan king, the sailors, right? And two things, like I always compare it to the Paul story, because right then Paul gets in a storm too, but Paul grabs an oar. And so one message from that story is when you're experiencing tribulation in the world, when there's struggle in like your immediate physical environment, don't go, hey, I'm God's chosen baby, and go below deck and take a nap. Grab a fucking oar and help out, right? Like the world is in trouble right now, and it doesn't need a bunch of judgmental, shitty Christians sitting on the sideline pointing their fingers and saying, nah, I told you so. We need them to grab an oar and help us out of the storm. The second thing is that storm stops when they throw the servant of God overboard, right? And so one thing that I think the message to Christians should be is that we're getting in the same boat. Right. And literally in terms of like the world is in a storm right now and it's a really bad one. And the servants of God are got their hands up, right? And pointing at us all and saying, you all deserve this. You're all burning.
Yeah,
you're all
going to
death. And so,
I told you.
And so just like in the book of Jonah, we might have to throw some of these assholes overboard to get the storm because they're not helping, right? They're not helping. And if they do come back, they come back with this shitty, judgmental, half-assed message. And so, you know, my message to the people of God is come up in your mind with the people who you think God hates the most and then go serve those people without question with your full heart. Right. And see what happens inside of you as in terms of transformation. Right. Because the message of the book of Jonah to me is not if a guy can live inside of a belly of a fish or not, is what do you do when you've assumed a privilege of being the spokesperson, the chosen spokesperson for the divine, for the transcendence. You better damn well situate yourself into a place of perpetual humility and service of other. Or else all you're doing is serving your own ego. And the book of Jonah is completely about that. I mean, it's completely about the absolute message of the prophet going completely awry. And by the time you get to Malachi, it's a mess.
It's a mess. Yeah. Well, and ironically, too, I think for Jonah, him being thrown overboard was acceptable. If I drown in the water, I still don't have to go to
talk to these homos. Yeah. Oh, cool. These pagans. Yeah.
So if I die,
be vegetarians up there in Nineveh.
So the fish comes and saves him, ironically, in the story. How do people get a hold of you? That's my question. If they want to talk to you at further length about all this stuff, what's the best way to contact you?
Probably at the moment until I get blocked again by Zuckerberg is looking me up, Andrew Gurvich on Facebook.
Facebook's the best way.
Facebook probably is for now. They can still get a hold of us through, the podcast that I was doing On the Block Radio for a while. I was on hiatus for a minute. After the last election, I kind of went into this like intake mode. I was like, I don't know what my culture is anymore. I don't know what I want to say to it.
Hibernate for a while.
And so I got to rethink what it is I want to even be talking. Part of my process of reconstruction is doing exactly that. How do I want to serve the world? How exactly do I want to think about these things and communicate them to people? And so I stopped doing a show for a minute to try to start reorienting, like what's the message I have for folks, right?
So it's on hiatus at the moment.
But they can probably, if they look up On the Block Radio, they can get to the website and there's an email address there too.
Right.
Or agingprophet@gmail.com as well.
Right. Okay. And so Aging Prophet, and you can always message me on Twitter at @mindshift2018. So thank you, Andrew Gurvich, the Aging Prophet.
The Aging Prophet. Yeah. And you know, Prophet, real quick, man, people get this thing weirded out. They go, Prophet, were you some kind of, right? And I always go, well, okay, lowercase p, right? If I start capitalizing the p, that's when you got to put me in a home.
Yeah,
that's when you got to call somebody and get me in a jacket. but prophets, as you know, I mean, I'd like to quickly, I know we're wrapping it up here, man, but I'd love to hear your take on this word, because when people ask me to explain why I use that, the aging part is clear because I'm old as fuck, right? Yeah, dinosaur.
Not getting any younger.
Yeah, man. But the prophet part, what do I mean by that? And prophets to me, it has to do with not predicting the future and not even necessarily being the mouthpiece for God, right? I mean, when people think of prophets, they think of someone who's predicting in 40, yeah. You know, there's going to be this hailstorm that's going to kill everybody in the town because God said, you know what I mean? Yeah. Or they're proclaiming some message. God tells the prophet, go tell people this. So they're this kind of mouthpiece for the divinity. But one of the other offices of prophet is someone who sits outside of the culture, a weirdo. You know, John, these guys eating bugs. Yeah. He's got a belt made of weird hair. You know, they sit apart enough from the culture, but are still connected to it and still have love for it, right? And are able to, because of the distance they have, but the connection they have to it, they are able to see some of the things wrong with it a little more clearly because they're not in the middle of it, right? If they're in the middle of it, they're too wrapped up in it. And if they're too detached from it, then they have no connection to it. But they sit apart from the community enough to get a little bit of perspective, but they're connected enough to it to have understanding. And the things that they are saying are commentary on the things that are holding the community back from experiencing full transformation. And these things tend to be the same over time. Like I was saying, the human animal, the human soul needs what it needs. And so when the people are struggling against, when they are Yisrael, when they are the ones who fight against that which their souls actually need the most, people tend to do this in the same ways over and over again. So a prophet is really just kind of like a psychologist. It's somebody who just knows the way that the people tend to stray and devour themselves and is able to speak to it. You know the future because you know the past. You've seen this happen over and over again.
It's a cyclical thing.
It's human nature. And so prophecy is not so much about predicting future events as it is understanding human nature, understanding the implications of human choices and where it inevitably leads over and over again when we serve the ego rather than serving one another. And so to me, I took that word on as, you know, the aging prophet to be one of the voices trying to call back to the community for it to help understand itself a little better and move itself more into these spaces of transformation and healing. Yeah. But I don't think I'm a prophet in that I received a special word or, a special,
special revelation.
Yeah. You don't need to come to me for this stuff.
What strikes me as ironic about what you're saying is, a lot of these things I hear, you said pastor, you still feel like you're a pastor.
Yeah.
Still a prophet.
Right.
These are all teaching.
Yeah.
You know, these are all gifts, as we know.
Right.
From the old Ephesians 4 passage.
Oh, man. Yeah. There you go.
But I feel like I have those same drives.
I think so,
that
too.
You do, that I want to speak into a community or whatever for whatever reason. I talk to a lot of people who come out of evangelicalism, as you probably do. Yeah. And I counsel them. I pastor them, in air quotes, whatever that means. So I'm doing all the things in a weird way that I was doing before.
Dude,
I'm
your World War One stuff is beautiful. Exactly. Like that, you're all jacked up on that. And those stories you were telling us yesterday about these personal narratives of this guy died right here and this was his life and this is what he cared about and this happened and it matters and we're connected to this guy. That's God stuff. Like to me, that's like,
whatever that means.
That's drawing that path, whatever that means, but that's making me aware of my quantum connectivity to some guy that died in a ditch in the middle of France in 1917 or something, right? Yeah. And on the surface, I don't know that I'm connected. It doesn't rise to my consciousness, but by putting that in my consciousness, I suddenly feel connected to the human story and the human family in this way that I hadn't before. You know what I mean? So there's a beauty in that, watching you get all jazzed about World War One and talk about that. Like on the surface, it doesn't seem like biblical stuff or like this is this guy's trip on World War One. But when you start diving into it, it starts manifesting not only how moving it is to your soul, but how you have this gift of making it matter to the listener. Like even if the person didn't know before that World War One, anything about it, suddenly they're like, I can feel why this matters, not only you. You know, as you're telling the story, but also to me, like this guy that died in this field, that matters to me somehow. And like, like I'm connected to that story. What led up to it and what led from it. Like the world we live in is still.
Yeah. The context.
Feeling the context of that. Yeah. And so that to me, that connectivity and the gratitude and the love that one experiences for that topic and then for those people that live through that. When you're asking about how I'm trying to reconstruct it, it's going in those directions, right? It's still trying to hold those offices, but rebranding them.
And we've said before, deconstruction looks different for everybody.
Yeah.
And so therefore, reconstruction must look different for everybody too. Yeah. Obviously, it's going to. It will. But you got to find a path somehow.
Yeah.
As you were saying at the beginning, you can't live in that anger. Well, you can, as you said. You absolutely can. but it's so unhealthy. It's so destructive.
It starts to eat at you
physically,
at some point.
Emotionally, yeah. Spiritually. It's exhausting. Yeah, it's exhausting. So, yeah, thanks so much, man. I've enjoyed it. I've loved this conversation.
It's awesome, man.
It's been great. We'll definitely do this again.
You got it. I want to do it in your spot next time, man.
We you come to up. Visit us, and we will do a recording on the rock.
Oh,
we'll
go to that would
the
be
pub.
So cool.
We'll have a pint. We'll do the whole thing. The whole pub.
We'll play some music, man. You'll get me over my fear of playing music in front of
We're
people.
We're
going to
do some open mic nights. So, yeah, that's going to happen. So, thanks, man, for being on Mindshift Podcast. I've loved it. It's been a great conversation.
It's been a blast, man.
When the next time I see you, we'll probably be on our turf.
On your turf. Showing me around.
All right. Thanks, man.
Thanks,
I'll talk to you on the rock next time you come visit me in Wales.
You got it, man. Thanks to your audience. This has been a blast.
Well, I don't know about you, but I sure learned a lot from Andrew once again. I love his phrase, shaking your fist at an empty sky and being so angry. And we talked about that. Really, what we're doing here is, as I say, the title of this episode, if you're reconstructing, you got to move past the anger, the bitterness phase, shaking your fist at an empty sky. We're really talking about, as he said, the total reorientation of our former worldview. And the problem, of course, as Andrew points out, is that in so much of evangelicalism, they have tied what should be core beliefs, or what they told us were core beliefs, with a lot of extra biblical ideas. Inerrancy, young earth creationism, the infallibility of the Bible. They just told us that these things were true, and we accepted it. We bought it if you were raised within religion like I was. But the problem was, as they began to crumble away and slough away, my whole faith kind of went with it, because it was all part and parcel of the whole house of cards. And I think it's important, too, as we said, you've got to acknowledge the anger, the fear, the resentment, the insecurity. You've got to experience those things as you go through the deconstruction process, and it absolutely will happen. It's very confusing, it's very threatening and fear-inducing, but then moving past it. How do you move past it? You got to acknowledge it. You got to process the anger of those past experiences, the hurts, the abuse, the ruptures in our ways of thinking, the wrongs that were done to us. But as we said, you can't stay in that. Well, you can, but it's unbelievably unhealthy. And so, as he said, can you sustain it? I don't think so. But if you do, it's going to come out in very unhealthy ways in other areas of your life. And so that is why I am here. That's why I do what I do, to help you move past the anger and the hurt and the grief and the bitterness from the past and move on into a sense of reconstructing, or constructing maybe, and reorienting your entire worldview, what you used to think, what you used to believe, and how we used to live in the past. So that's what I want to do. And again, as I say, moving forward into the new year, that's what I'm going to be focusing on as well. Now, what's coming up in the next couple of weeks? We've got Andrew Jasko, who was on the podcast also earlier this year. We're going to be talking about the Protestant work ethic. We're going to be talking about spirituality, nature, getting into all kinds of stuff. Then I've got a nameless guest as well coming up after that, one Seamus Clark, in air quotes. We're going to be talking about the film, The Last Temptation of Christ. And this is a fascinating case study. It is now, in 2018, the 30th anniversary of that movie. And what we want to talk about is the evangelical, the fundamentalist response to the film. And what does that mean in terms of deconstructing our views of the Gospels and the Jesus story? Why did that movie cause such an uproar when it came out in 1988? And the evangelicals, the Catholics, the fundamentalists absolutely freaked out. Why? We're going to get into that in a couple of weeks. So stay tuned for Andrew Jasko and Seamus Clark, in air quotes, coming up in a couple of weeks. Listen, I hope you've enjoyed this conversation that I brought you with Andrew Gurevich. The trip to Portland was more than worth it for a lot of reasons, but most importantly, I hope it has helped you. So stay tuned. Come back next week. Catch my conversation with Andrew Jasko as we get into all kinds of great topics around this subject of exploring spirituality, which is an incredibly important piece in the reconstruction process. Once again, I have been your host, Dr. Clint Haycock. Thanks for joining me and Andrew Gurevich along this journey of reconstruction, the total reorientation of your former worldview. I'll see you next Friday right here on Mindshift Podcast.